you know, probably the proudest moment in my shooting career. Sporting Clays started in England, and it came to the U.S., you know, 20 years after that all the people in England had already been competing, right? So when you have a, when someone has a 20-year head start on you in a sport, it's extremely difficult to be competitive. First 15 years of my shooting, from the time I was 10 years old to 25 years old, the Americans got beat at the World Championships regularly, okay? We didn't win any World Championships. They knew more, they were more experienced, their sport was more advanced, their targets were more difficult. In 2016, I won the World Sporting Clays Championship, which is the which I was the first American to do that. So, you know, that was a, yeah, that was a big deal, you know? So, you know, the, to be the first person to do something in your sport, you know, that was important to me.
One of the most renowned shooters in the world of sporting clays, Anthony Matarese Jr., is a living legend. Anthony was the first American to hold the honor of winning the World Sporting Clays Championship, and in 2020, became the first person to win all four major sporting clays titles during his shooting career. As a highly respected and sought-after shooting instructor, Anthony regularly has students fly in from all parts of the country to New Jersey for lessons, where he owns and operates M&M Hunting and Sporting Clays, one of the only full-service clay shooting and hunting operations in the U.S. On this episode, Anthony will talk about his ideal shotgun and ammunition setup for competition and will also discuss his training regimen. He'll also dive into the competitive mindset that has helped him become one of the most successful American sporting clay shooters of all time. Welcome to the Winchester Life Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Brown. Welcome to the Winchester Life Podcast. Through insider access to industry pioneers, firsthand looks at cutting-edge tech advancements, and the stories behind the scenes that have shaped the world of shooting sports and hunting as we know it, we'll dive into the sacred places like deer camps and duck blinds, talk about innovation and shooting tips with the world's best, while revisiting age-old traditions of hunting and shooting still alive in our country. I'm your host, Jason Brown, and welcome to the show. The Winchester Life Podcast is brought to you by Winchester Ammunition, Winchester Repeating Arms, Winchester Safes, White Flyer Targets, Folds of Honor, Birchwood Casey, Walkers, Winchester Pet, and Winchester Optics. All right, Anthony Matarese, how are you? Welcome to the Winchester Life Podcast.
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Good, man. We were just chatting. You have some instruction going on your out on the range today. What's the temps like out there?
We were low 30s. I didn't look exactly, but we had some wind, so it was cold.
Yeah, challenging. Well, thanks for hopping on with us. I think what you know when I was. Had a chance to come down and a couple times and visit your facility and the family's facility and just kind of see how you guys run things down there. And I was extremely impressed. I mean, it was top notch and you guys definitely have the reviews to back it up. You have the students continue to book you out and it's a great place to be. And, you know, backing it up. I mean, you've had an incredible sporting clays career. What initially in the beginning, what drew you to the sport, and you know, what, when did you realize you had a potential to compete and do things at a high level?
Yeah, so I'll give you kind of the history. I grew up, my family has a hunting preserve, and at the time we were a game bird farm, we put in a small sporting clay range in 1991. So I was like 7 years old when we put that in, which was just manual machines and really something for the hunters to do to get ready for hunting season, or something for our people that were on our preserve hunting to warm up, or to, you know, add something else for them to do in a morning or an afternoon, you know, before or after the hunt. And having grown up around that, I, you know, was out throwing clays and taking the people through the course, and had hunted. You know, my dad had taken me, you know, duck hunting, goose hunting, deer hunting, and I started to shoot some on the clay range. You know, to be honest with you, I can't even tell you, you know, if I started at that point when I was 7 or I was 8 or 9 or
right.
But I entered my first competition in 1995 at 10 years old.
Yep.
And my dad had gotten into going to some competitions mainly because we started to host some competitions at our range, and the sport was growing at the time. And, you know, most clay sporting clay ranges at the time was just manual machines. So he was going to some competitions. He was never really an avid competitor. He was more there for, you know, the business standpoint to understand what was going on. So he actually went to some competitions before I ever did. And then my brother was also competing at the time. He's younger than me. And we started going to some local tournaments and did that. And in 1996, you know, so like a year and a half later, my mom took me to the national championship and competed in the national championship as a sub junior, and, you know, loved it. Was, you know, competitive by personality and, you know, striving to do well. And
yeah.
I've been shooting competitively ever since. Right. So in terms of, you know, when did I decide I was going to be a competitor? I guess when I entered my first competition.
And, yeah.
And I enjoyed it and I loved the challenge, you know. And then I competed all through high school and into college, and probably when I graduated college was the time where I just, you know, was an important time to make a decision. You know, I was a straight A student my whole life, did well in college. I could have done really whatever I wanted to do for a career. And I had taught shooting. I started teaching shooting when I was 15 years old,
yeah.
Partly out of necessity because people were coming to the range and needed to learn. And I had really good instruction. Dan Carlisle was my coach as a kid, so I had a really good understanding of the game, and I was shooting well at the time. So the reason that has significance is because when I graduated college, I already had a big basis of teaching shooting. I actually went home from college every single weekend and gave instruction. Mm-hmm. You know, in 4 years of college, I spent probably one weekend at college.
Yeah.
Just because I had already started that business.
Yeah, you're focused.
Yeah, I already started that business before, and I, you know, I had students, and I didn't, you know, want to, you know, not continue it. So the reason that has significance is because then when I graduated college, I had some job interviews, et cetera, and looked at, you know, what would be required of me and the challenges I would have to continue shooting after, you know, devoting, you know, the last 10 or 11 years of my life to it.
Yeah.
And I decided to just continue teaching shooting. And then that allowed me to also kind of work within my family business, you know. But I, even still today, I still spend the majority of my time teaching shooting and then help them run that operation kind of more on the, you know, operations standpoint and marketing standpoint, et cetera. So
yeah.
It was probably when I graduated college that I said, you know, I'm going to actually give this a try to, you know, make a career out of this more than, you know, just go to competitions, you know, as a junior and a youth and see where, you know, so that decision to compete, you know, obviously when I started my first competition at age 10, but the decision to try to make something out of it more than a hobby was when I graduated college.
Yeah. We'll come back to your career, but I want to back up a little bit. Sporting clays, some of the listeners might not understand 100% the difference between sporting clays and trap and skeet. Explain the difference. What is it that makes sporting clays so different?
You're right. So if we back up, historic sporting clays is relatively new in the United States compared to skeet or trap. Trap shooting is, you know, one machine in front of you. The target oscillates left to right. You have the different yardages. Most people are shooting trap on the 16-yard line, but you have one target that's in front of you, and it's more or less a straightaway shot with slight angles left and right. Skeet shooting, which skeet is is two machines, one on the left side of the field, one on the right side of the field. The traps are 40 yards apart, basically a half circle, and you shoot at eight positions to make up a round of 25 shooting those two machines. You'll hear the word skeet shooting commonly used, like, hey, you guys, if I tell someone I'm a competitive shooter and I shoot clay targets, they say, oh, like skeet shooting?
Yeah.
You know, and the reason why they use the word is because it's kind of the generic word for clay shooting, because it's been around a long time.
Sure.
So skeet and trap were, you know, going on in the 1950s, you know, before that even, but you know, it was an organized discipline in the 1950s, and sporting clays did not really become an organized discipline until the late 80s to early 90s.
Yeah.
Sporting clays is basically the equivalent of shooting clays on the equivalent of going through like a golf course. You have different, every station is the equivalent of going to a different hole on a golf course. And at each station, you could have a target coming from behind you, coming in, running on the ground. Originally, it's designed to simulate hunting more so and more realistic than skeet or trap. Nowadays, we still have lots of people that are out shooting sporting clays that are hunters, but we have a large contingent of people shooting sporting clays that are not hunters.
Yeah.
And they're just out there because sporting clays is their hobby. So that's gives you a comparison of the two, and then gives you a little bit of the historical nature of, you know, where we've come, you know, from skeet and trap to sporting clays. Sporting clays is now the most popular and the biggest segment of clay target shooting.
Yeah, and how's it evolved since the beginning? I know it's kind of been brought over to America, would you say, in the early 90s, late 80s, but what's changed in the last 25 years in sporting clays?
So when we started, the biggest difference is when we started, it was a manual machine that was thrown by hand, and you would have a trapper, you know, a puller that would cock the machine and send the clay, you know, when you would call pull. And most of the time at that point in time in the late 80s, early 90s, it was just one machine at a station throwing one angle, and they might put two targets on the machine and throw a double, true pair or simo pair. We evolved to then sometimes having a manual machine coupled with an automated machine where you just push the button and it's battery operated and releases the clay automatically. To fast forward, everything's automated at any of the more serious ranges, and the sport has grown and the number of venues has grown, and you know, it's kind of developed into a, you know, it went really from practice for hunters to a sport in and of its own, which still provides the practice for hunters as well today.
Yeah, to me, I've done a lot of stories through Winchester and been to a lot of events. It really almost feels like sporting clays is like the rock stars. It's kind of gotten to the point where, in my opinion, just from the outside looking in, there's so much energy in those events. To me, I don't know why that is. If it's just because each hole, each course has different presentations. I don't know why that is. If there's a more of a youth movement in sporting clays. I know high school has a big youth movement going with sporting clays. Is there a reason that is it a younger sport?
We have a broad, you know, variety of, you know, if we look at the demographics, there is a lot of kids. These youth programs have helped a lot. There are a lot of kids shooting. The in competitive shooting, you know, I think you can answer your question two ways. In recreational shooting, people just going out and having fun and going with their buddies, the demographic is super broad.
Yeah.
Okay. From young to old to, you know, all different walks of life. And in competitive shooting, probably the majority of the participants at a lot of major competitions are a little bit older, you know, just because, you know, they, you know, people are at a time in their life where they have disposable income and free time. It's still a broad demographic. I think that we have growth. It's still growing. We have a lot of great shooting venues throughout the country. And the venues are continuing to improve to be able to host bigger crowds. And, you know, the energy I feel like that you see at a lot of competitions is, you know, there's a definitely a a big social aspect related to going there and being part of something. And the venues do a really good job of welcoming people and making it a show. It's like, you know, if you show up at a sporting clay competition, it's like you're at a major sporting clay competition. It's like a festival for shooting, right? Yeah. They don't necessarily have quite as much of that in, say, skeet shooting or trap shooting, compared to, you know, we're still in a growth phase, both for recreational and competitive shooting. And there's a lot of excitement. People are excited to be there. You have competition, you have social gatherings, you know, families are welcomed. There's just a lot of, you know, there's a lot of things that make it enjoyable, you know. And, you know, if you're at the event and you're a diehard competitor or you like to compete, but you're really there to enjoy yourself, there's something for everyone.
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of shooters approach target presentations maybe a little differently. What's your strategy to consistently break targets, like your personal strategy to breaking targets consistently?
So, if we look at it both personally and then just giving the people that are listening something that's going to help them as well, it boils down to fundamentals, right? So how you stand, how you mount your gun. Most people shooting a shotgun are looking way too much at the barrel and trying to measure the lead.
Yeah.
And if you have correct fundamentals where your feet are right and your body movement is right and your gun mount is right, then you understand the different angles, speeds, and distances. Lead is, you know, the magic thing is the gun's got to be in the right position in front of the bird to break it. So you have to have the right lead. But if you're just looking for the right lead, you're not going to be a very good shot with a shotgun.
Yeah.
So you have to understand that lead is kind of a combination between a science and a feel. A combination between a science and an art, and there's a lot of trusting yourself and hands and eyes working together. And if the fundamentals are correct, you can get to that, right? So yeah. You got to be standing the right way, mounting the gun the right way. If there's a part of my game that, you know, is just as important to me as it would be a novice, is learning how to use your hands and eyes together. Shooting a clay target is closer to catching and hitting a baseball than it is shooting a rifle. Mm-hmm. So if you can understand, you know, how to throw a football and lead someone running down the field, you have a better chance of being successful with a shotgun than if you are an expert with a 22.
Yep.
Shooting at a still target, because shooting a rifle at a still target has very little to do with shooting clay targets.
Yeah. Something that you showed us last time we were down, and I've seen it actually posted multiple times. I think actually you or Winchester might have just posted it this week, was that laser that your buddy brought, and you shot some video, and it was really revealing. Yep. At how much you actually had to lead at different distances that clay.
Yep.
Is there something, I mean, I think to me it just, it really hit home how far you guys are leading that thing.
Yeah, so what that did, and, you know, anybody that's listening, it's on my Instagram and on my Facebook, because it's definitely, if you want to be a better shot, it's worth going and finding it. If you look up AIM shooting, you can find me on Instagram or on Facebook. But so what it does is, for the first time maybe ever with trying to video shooting and show someone what to do, you can see the movement of the gun, not just where the shooter is, but out at the target,
yeah.
Right? So you can see how it gets there. You can see how it moves. You can see the, you know, how far in front that it is. So, it's really for demonstration purposes so that people can look at it and go, wow, I didn't really understand that that's what I was trying to do with my shotgun, right?
Yeah.
And you also, if you're looking at it, you can see that the gun speed and the target speed are very similar, right? You can't have a big disparity between the speed of your gun and the speed of the clay. If you have a big disparity between the speed of the gun and the speed of the clay, you'll be inconsistent. a lot of, you know, back to your original question about, you know, about my shooting. If you can get the gun speed and the bird speed together, the idea of leading things becomes a little bit easier. Yeah. If the gun speed and the bird speed are out of synchronization, becomes very difficult. So that footage that you're referring to really allows you to understand what that means.
Yeah.
Not only just how to get there, how far in front of different shots require, but what, how the synchronization of the gun and the bird, have to get together.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when you guys throw, you know, before you actually shoot, sometimes what do they call that when you throw a couple, they show you a couple,
you get a view pair.
Yep. Yeah, view pair,
you get a show pair.
Yeah, show pair. You guys are a lot of, you're following it with your hands and you're following it, it kind of is doing that, right? It's getting you in the
yeah,
rhythm.
You're basically, yeah, what you're doing with your hand is you're trying to use your hand to simulate the movement that you're going to do with your gun.
Yep.
To basically give you a rehearsal of what you're doing, because if you're doing, for these competitive shooters that you're referencing, for them to be operating and executing at their highest level, you're trying to be as subconscious as possible, meaning you've trained yourself how to hit that shot historically, and then now you're trying to trust yourself to be able to hit that bird. So using your hand is giving you the opportunity to rehearse what you're going to do, and it's giving you a visualization more so than just thinking about what to do.
Yeah. You know, to that point, I mean, mental toughness is huge, sporting clays. How do you handle that pressure in major competitions? And kind of what advice would you give somebody that might be struggling with that, with kind of the nerves or big moments?
All right. So there's a few different, we'll break it into a couple different categories. You know, when you're in the box and you're in the station, you need a simple routine. Okay. Which is just things that you're going to do the same every time. If you watch a video of me shooting, which is easy enough to find online, you'll see me put my shells in and I'll spin the shells and line up, shoot Winchester ammunition. I line up the writing, right, where it says Winchester or 12 gauge on the top of the shell. I line it up the same every time. So that's consistency. Step yeah. one in being consistent is being consistent. And then that allows you to have something that you're doing every time. So you need a simple routine to remind yourself to do the same thing each time. You need to have a general routine that allows you to feel comfortable in the day of the competition. You know, general routine might be as simple as what time you're gonna wake up, what are you gonna eat for breakfast, and how long, what time you're gonna get to the range. You have to do something that puts you in a comfortable environment. You yeah. know, when you're comfortable in your environment because you're in control of things that you can control, your ability to execute's a little bit higher, you know. Yeah. So control what you can. Don't worry about what you can't control. Have a routine. And then your mindset is huge, right? You know, so mindset is, a lot of people step out to the range and they're trying to win, or they're trying to do well. That's where pressure comes from. Most pressure is really internal. So the pressure is brought upon by your desire to be successful and not fail. You know, they say, well, you know, where does the, you know, if the pressure is internal, then it comes upon yourself. So you're worried about how well you're going to do, or you're worried about how other people perceive your results, right? That's what you're worried about. Yeah. Right. So, I'm either worried that, you know, I want to do well, or I'm, you know, the guy's worried that if I don't do well, I'm not going to get a sponsor, and I'm trying to, or, you know, my friends are going to think I'm a bad shot. Right. Yeah. So, that's where the pressure comes from. So the only way you get rid of that is you have the correct mindset, right? You know, so the correct mindset is, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to hit every bird that I'm capable of hitting. And when the event's over, I'll see what the result is. Okay. Yeah. You know, if I have to shoot a 15 station course, I'm going to shoot 15 stations, but I'm actually just going to shoot one pair of targets at a time. And when the day is over, we'll see what the result is. You know, there's two possible outcomes. You're going to be successful or you're not. Okay. Both are inevitable. Okay. Yeah. There's no one in any sport, whether recreational, middle school, high school, or professional, that was successful every time they stepped onto the field. So you're guaranteed to be unsuccessful at times, regardless of your level of proficiency and your skill set and your devotion to the sport, et cetera. So yeah. if you're worrying about being winning or you're worrying about being successful or not, you know, you're worried about the wrong thing because it's going to happen. And worrying about it is just making the likelihood of it happening higher.
Yeah.
So, you know, practice, prepare yourself, step out on the field and play the game. If you win, it's great. If you lose, it sucks. But you start over again on Monday anyway.
Yeah, that's true. So, I mean, you've competed and won at the highest level in sporting clays. What are some of the wins or even some of the defining moments that you can look back on at your career? And you're still going. I mean, you're still at the peak of your career. What are some of the ones that stand out to you?
You know, probably the proudest moment in my shooting career. Sporting clays started in England and it came to the U.S., you know, 20 years after that. All the people in England had already been competing, right? So when someone has a 20-year head start on you in a sport, mm-hmm. It's extremely difficult to be competitive. And in the first 15 years of my shooting, from the time I was 10 years old to 25 years old, the Americans got beat at the World Championships regularly, okay? We didn't win any World Championships in, you know, the first 15 or 20 years of the time that I spent shooting. And a part of that time, I was too young to even, you know, be realistically a great competitor. But the guys that were older than me started with a massive disadvantage because the people in England had been practicing our discipline for 20 years prior.
Yeah.
They knew more, they're more experienced, their sport was more advanced, their targets were more difficult. In 2016, I won the World Sporting Clays Championship, which I was the first American to do
big
that.
Deal.
So, you know, that was a big deal, you know. So, you know, to be the first person to do something in your sport and having grown up watching, you know, I had been to every world championship, you know, since I was 14 years old. And so to go to every world championship since you're 14 years old and never see an American win, you know, that was important to me. And that was kind of a defining moment in sporting clays for the U.S. being more competitive on a world level, you know. Just partly because it was our time, you know, we had finally caught up and our sport here has advanced significantly more than, you know, we've left them behind. We've left the rest of the world really behind. If you can think of, you know, Americans overdoing things and, you know, the sporting clays in America is way ahead of sporting clays anywhere else in the world. And the advancement in our sports and the professionalism and all the good gun clubs we've had. So it was partly our time. You know, I won when we finally had caught up from an experience curve. Yeah. And, you know, since then we've had three or four Americans win since then, win the world championship since I won, you know, so it was kind of a defining moment to be the first person to do that. You know, that was that's probably the most memorable thing in my career.
Yeah.
I've won the U.S. Open 4 times, which is a hard championship to win. Some of the best competitors that we have in the United States have not won it before, you know, so that's a big deal to me.
Huge
to be able to have done that.
Stay tuned for part 2 of this week's conversation, but first, after the break, we'll talk with Winchester's Ben Frank and dive into everything ammunition on our weekly Ammo 101 segment. This portion of the Winchester Life Podcast has been brought to you by Winchester Safes. Built with reliability and dependability, Winchester Safes offers proven security for your memories, possessions, and most importantly, your peace of mind. Visit winchestersafes.com to learn more. White Flyer Targets. For more than 130 years, White Flyer has provided the highest quality clay target for trap, skeet, and sporting clays. White Flyer, America's best. Birchwood Casey. Since 1948, serious shooters, avid collectors, and professional gunsmiths have relied on Birchwood Casey for shooting and gun care products that have stood the test of time. To learn more, visit birchwoodcasey.com. On our AMO 101 segment today, we've got Ben Frank from Winchester Ammunition, and he's going to walk us through some of the waterfowl products that Winchester has to offer. Ben, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. I love talking about waterfowl, so we got a lot to talk about.
We do, and you were just not too long ago snow goose hunting, weren't you?
Yep. Yeah, and honestly, I can't really tell you the exact stuff I was using on that one because it's something we got coming out this fall.
Oh, but, nice.
Pretty exciting stuff. We had a really good trip, and it's a great way to, you know, get out there and test new ammo if the birds come in, which we had a pretty good weekend, so it was fun.
Yeah, it's fun. You never know with snows, man. They're so temperamental. I hate them and I love them at the same time because when they're in, it seems like you're shooting all day, and when they're not, you're getting baked in the sun. I don't know. I think I've had more sunburns waiting for snow geese in the middle of the fields than I have on spring break over the years.
Oh, yeah. I definitely had some windburn and sunburn on my face, but that's just from staring up all day, which was, it was a good time. But I think I heard geese in my sleep for probably about a week. So
that's yeah. So take us through, you know, in my opinion, I think Winchester probably has the most deep assortment of waterfowl products out there. And the technology that is continuing, it seems like year over year, is just insane. You want to take us through some of the products?
Yeah, and I'll start with, you know, waterfowl's been a core product line for Winchester for a long time. I mean, if you think back to John Olin and Nilo, which you guys have been out there a ton, you know, a lot of the things revolve around waterfowl hunting and, you know, waterfowl dogs and all that. And it's very important to us. And it's also one of the largest categories of end use for hunters out there today. So as you said, we have a very diverse lineup. I'll start with Expert. So if you're a waterfowl hunter out there and you're cost conscious, you've probably shot or had, you know, a lot of different cases of Expert roll through your house at some point or another. I know that's pretty much where I started back whenever I was a kid. That's one of the first things we ever shot was Expert. And yeah, it's still a staple for us today. It's patented technology that we have there. I mean, the patents are probably even up by now because it's been around so long. But that shot technology, that high velocity, has really been a standard for us. And it continues to perform season after season.
So with the Expert, and you're totally right. Like if I go to when I first started a waterfowl hunt, it was Expert. You know, you can get it everywhere. You can get it everywhere. And I filled my waterfowl bag with Expert, and I still do. You know, it's kind of like that go-to.
Yeah, for sure. And especially if, so like a lot of our other products have a lot of different water resistant technologies in them, and Expert does as well. But what really stands some of those other products apart from Expert a lot of times is plated shot. So Expert, to be able to hit different price points, to be able to be as cost effective as possible, we do everything we can to make it the highest performance, but at the lowest cost we can get. But when you start stepping into products like Dry Lock or, you know, Blindside, when we have Blindside, those products are plated steel. And I mentioned that because when you start to be in those situations where we're waterfowl hunting, and a lot of times, as you know, you're going to get wet, whether that's you're in waders or you're just laying in a layout blind getting rained on or whatever, oftentimes your gear is going to get wet, and that includes your ammo. And a lot of times you can't see inside of a shot shell. Most of the time you can't unless you cut one down. But if you look at some of your shells after they've been cut down, and if you've been getting them wet, oftentimes that shot, if it's plated, it's going to look great. You know, if it's not plated, sometimes it could get a little rust on it, and that even just a little bit of rust might impact your patterns because your shot's not going to be as round anymore.
So for someone who doesn't know what plated shot means compared to regular shot, how's that? What is it? What's the process? Or talk through that a little bit.
Yeah, sorry, I got my dog barking here in the background.
Oh, yeah.
So it is not a duck dog. It's a house dog. Sorry. But so anyway, yeah, we take steel shot and we'll send that off to a plating process, and it'll typically get plated with something like a zinc plating. And really what we do with that after the fact is we will actually go test that stuff in different, like a salt spray test or things like that are really aggressive to try to make sure that shot is going to resist any corrosion, resist any rusting. Because again, we don't know what kind of situations our customers are going to put themselves in, but I know myself, I've been in some pretty, you know, rough hunting situations when it comes to waterfowl hunting. And it, you know, we want to make sure that stuff's going to work every time. And if it does happen to get wet, it's not going to rust.
Yeah, I mean, waterfowl, the nature of it is you're mostly hunting around water most of the time, or, you know, the weather and the elements kind of, you know, make things what it is sometimes. So, yeah, having that plated shot. In dry lock, too, what makes dry lock unique? Talk about when you guys kind of developed that technology in dry lock.
Yeah, that goes back. We've had some great engineers with Winchester, you know, over the course of time. I listened to your first podcast that you had out there about just the people, and it really kind of made me start thinking about particularly waterfowl and some of the products that we've done there over the years, just because of the passion that our group of people that are in that group had and still have to this day. But a lot of that was on the cusp of where you had to use steel instead of lead, right? So those guys back then were looking at all this, you know, I'll call it reduced performance compared to what they had been seeing prior to with lead, and trying to figure out ways to really get that stuff back up to par with where they once were. And it's tough to do that with steel versus lead, but some of the things that they were able to do just were amazing for the time, particularly with primer developments, with powder developments, but you know, particularly with that dry lock system, a big chunk of that was how do we keep the powder dry? Because if you don't keep the powder dry, what's going to end up happening is you end up causing issues with maybe the gun doesn't go off or gets plugged up with a wad, kind of acts like where you maybe end up getting an inbore situation, which is not something that anyone wants to have happen in a hunting situation, particularly whenever you're just following a bird and pulling the trigger.
Yeah.
So keeping the powder dry is a key to ensuring that thing goes off properly every time. I mean, it's probably worse when it kind of only goes off, right? Because it may not even, you know, go out the end of your barrel.
Yeah. We've had back in the day, you know, you get some buddies that use, you know, rusty shells or compromised primers or whatever, and you get like a hang fire, you know, they pull the trigger and nothing happens. The first thing that what I always say is point that thing. It's, you know, that sucker could be burning still, you know? So, yeah, I mean, when you deal with damp conditions, a lot of times when you come home, you're inside of your waterfowl bag's wet, and you just leave it closed up in your garage till the next time, and you open it up and your gloves stink and it's mildew everywhere. But yeah, I mean, that's the nature of waterfowl hunting. But then bismuth comes along, and that's kind of the next line that you know you guys can talk about here.
Yeah, so bismuth even was something that's been around for a while as well. It's a little bit more pricey than, say, steel is, but it definitely is higher performance. You got a higher density shot. So, again, you're going back to the time when we were using things like lead. Waterfowl hunters have been looking for ways to be able to get that type of performance, right? Well, bismuth is going to get you closer to that due to the density. Now, bismuth poses some other potential, I'll call it engineering hurdles that you got to do to be able to get that stuff to work right. And bismuth is oftentimes kind of brittle. And what that means is whenever you go to pull the trigger, if you don't protect that shot properly, the shot pellets will actually break apart, particularly down at the bottom of your shell. And so if you ever pattern bismuth with pretty much anybody who doesn't buffer their bismuth, or they have really heavy payloads. A lot of times you'll look at the paper and you'll see these little busted up pellets. You'll see little flakes, maybe funky holes that look at like grit has hit the pattern board. Yeah. Well, that's actually pieces of bismuth that have broken apart when you pulled the trigger. So when we developed bismuth in the last few years here, we found that it's like, we got to buffer this stuff. If someone's going to pay that kind of money for that performance, we want all of those pellets to be going to the target. And so we developed a bismuth load that we're super proud of. It works great. I've used it a bunch on different things, and you definitely get added distance, added performance than you'll get with just about any steel shot load that's out there today. It's really hard to battle that density. So if you've got something like bismuth in your pocket, you're a leg up when it comes to chasing waterfowl.
Yeah. And when you say buffer, explain what you mean by buffer.
Yeah. So like with turkey loads, as a, for instance, is where kind of buffering typically is talked about. I know on some of the other podcasts, we talked like about Longbeard and Longbeard TSS. And when we buffer shot, it's really trying to fill up that space in between the shot. So imagine you got two round balls sitting next to each other, hundreds of the round balls sitting next to each other, and there's airspace in between there. When you pull the trigger, those pellets want to bump into each other. And that pressure causes those bismuth pellets in particular to want to crack. And it's difficult to keep those things together even with plating. So we buffer it. We put stuff in between there to kind of cushion that blow. And it helps those pellets stay round, and it helps them from cracking in the case of bismuth, and it just puts a lot more pellets on target.
Sure. And you know, I think that was kind of the, you know, you can talk to blindside, but I think that was that hex shot, why that was created, right? To kind of fit together.
Yeah, I mean, on hex shot, that was really to kind of fill up some space, because those flats kind of helped allow it to pack better. We called it packing density. And that wasn't necessarily to try to protect the pellets. Steel or TSS, those products, they're very hard. They don't really end up breaking down when you shoot them. But we wanted to have more space in the shell to be able to put some cushion in there so we could get more velocity. So steel, less dense, takes up a heck of a lot more space in your shell. So to be able to get higher velocities with higher payloads, you got to put something in there to kind of cushion that blow.
Yeah. So talk to Blindside. That's a product that's going to be going away this year. Is that right?
Yeah. Blindside was around for about 10 years. It was another great product that I actually got to work on Blindside. I helped develop the Diamond Cut Wad, which was a really cool process. Myself and another one of our engineers, Steve Meyer, were making individual hex pellets one by one on a, you know, on a press, just to be able to get enough to try to test some of this stuff for patterns. And
wow.
It was really cool, but you know, it's kind of ran its course now. And we've got some really cool new products coming out here in 2025 that I think people will be really excited about. So Blindside, we went to Blindside too for there for a bit. And, you know, we found that we just really weren't moving as much Blindside as what we once were. And I think hunters and shooters were looking for something a little different. Well, this fall, we've got some cool stuff for you.
Yeah, and last fall, I guess really this year at SHOT, introduced Last Call. Talk a little bit about Last Call.
Yeah, Last Call is going to be the cream of the crop in terms of waterfowl loads. It's 100% 18 grams per cubic centimeter density TSS, so that tungsten super shot that a lot of people may have heard about, you know, when it comes from the turkey side of the business. A lot of people probably shot TSS at turkeys and found that this stuff is just amazing in terms of the amount of pellets you can put on target, the kind of patterns that you can get. And people today, I think, are looking for ways to have the highest performance. It's not easy to get out there in the woods or in the field or in, you know, in a lake to go hunt. And if you're going to go, you want to make sure that you have the best opportunity to harvest those birds, and TSS is going to do that. I mean, I think more and more people are finding that they're willing to spend a little bit more on ammunition if it's going to provide them with true performance improvements. And TSS really does that. It does cost more, but shoot some at some paper sometime, or even just go out if you do have somebody with you and you can go actually hunt with it. It's pretty amazing what it can do.
Yeah, I think as life gets busier, there's more things going on. I think more than ever, when you go out into the woods on the water, waterfowl hunting, deer hunting, you want the best technology in your hands to create the best opportunity for success. And I think, you know, Last Call, you and I both used it last year. It's insane. It's hard to even explain how good it is until you actually run it. It's a game changer. Changes the way it changes that range a little bit. And not only that, but it just it kills them dead. I mean, just yeah. It's insane how hard it hits.
Yeah, and the thing that I think once if people are interested or thinking about using TSS for waterfowl hunting, you really want to look at the shot sizes. So we've been so accustomed to using, say, like twos for ducks or threes for ducks, maybe fours if you're shooting a little smaller ducks, and BBs for geese, right? So, you know, you go to the store, you know what shot size you're looking for when it comes to steel. Well, it's a totally different game when you start talking about using products like bismuth or TSS. I mean, bismuth, you can step down to a smaller shot size. Like if you're normally using a two, well, now you can use a four in bismuth to hunt ducks.
Yep.
When you start talking about TSS, you're talking about using not number nine shot,
yeah,
which is like, that's incredible. And most times people think nine shot is like, so small. How could it work? You know, but it gets as much or more penetration than a number two with significantly, I mean, 100+ more pellets. So it's amazing what you can do with these smaller pellets. But it's kind of that educational process of trying to, if you were shooting a two at a duck, it would just be a two TSS be way overkill. And yeah, you wouldn't really be getting the performance advantage that you're going to get with TSS because it's that added pellet count that you get with those high density pellets.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the innovation, I mean, it doesn't stop it. Last Call. I mean, like you kind of teased earlier, there's some stuff coming out, this summer potentially that you guys will be announcing?
Yep, for sure. We got a couple of really cool new things coming. And, you know, we're always focused on really everybody out there, right? And I say that by meaning we got everything from expert, which is, you know, going to be your cheap and cheerful, the most cost-effective product that we have, all the way to Last Call. And we're always looking for those different niches of hunters out there when we're coming out with new products. So it's no different in waterfowl. That's what you're going to see this summer. It's going to be something in between those two. That's kind of a, you know, wide range of what it could be, but going to be, I think, very exciting for a lot of folks who are out there chasing waterfowl.
Yes, it is. Ben, thank you so much for taking the time to walk us through the waterfowl line for Winchester, man. Have a great day.
You too. Thanks a lot, Jason.
Coming up next on the Winchester Life podcast is part two of our guest conversation. But first, a few words from our partners. The Winchester Life podcast is brought to you by Winchester Ammunition, Winchester Repeating Arms, Winchester Safes, White Flyer Targets, Folds of Honor, Birchwood Casey, Walkers, Winchester Pet, and Winchester Optics. What I love about hearing a lot of that is you know, being able to come down to your facility, M&M, your family's facility, and to hear that and to know that last year you guys hosted the first World English held in the United States, correct?
No, it was the first one we hosted.
First one you guys hosted.
The first one. Yeah, but it generally goes from the World Sporting Clay Championship goes from England to the U.S. back and forth each year.
Back and forth.
The World FITES Championship, which is a low gun discipline, that goes all over the world. That rotates through a lot of different countries. This year, we'll be traveling to Cyprus to shoot the World FITES Championship there.
Okay. What I loved about going to your facility is there's a lot of the stuff you've won. I mean, you've been competing for so long. What, 25 years or more probably at this point?
Yeah, this is my 31st year. I'm 40 years old.
Yeah, so, but just to see the evolution of your shooting career, you know, at the facility, You guys have a lot of the trophies and a lot of the cards and a lot of the medals and photos. It's just really cool to see really the history of your shooting career kind of unfold in front of your eyes as you kind of check a lot of that stuff out. And then we had a crew down covering the World English this last year, and just to see the event and how the, you know, the pride, the different countries, how they were represented in the flags and all that stuff. What was it like not only to be part of it, but to run it at your facility? I'd imagine it had to be a huge deal.
Yeah. I mean, we're super excited to do it. You know, it's a big undertaking to do a good job. You know, there's a lot of small details. We had 1700 competitors there for a week, plus all the vendors and spectators and, you know, people working, et cetera. So there's, you know, at least 2,500 people on the grounds at all time.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, we wanted to do a really good job. You know, I've we've been hosting competitions for a long, long time. We've hosted the U.S. Open at our M&M four times before. So we had the experience. This one was bigger than anything we had ever done. You know, it was a great accomplishment to do it, you know, on the same time, if you're trying to do a really good job at something that, you know, got a lot of pressure on you to pull it off.
Yeah. A lot of pressure. The shoot-offs were cool. I mean, there's just a lot of, you know, country pride, which I think, shines through, but I think behind the scenes, you guys are all chatting it up. I mean, what's it like to compete in something where you're representing your country like that?
I mean, it's a big deal, you know. So, I mean, if someone is a competitor and they're made the, you know, you can compete in that championship as just an open, you know, shooting individually, or you can, if you've made the selection, you're representing your team, whether you're from England or the U.S. or whatever, you know, so you've made it to the highest level to, you know, if you're in the men's category, you're the top four or five guys in your country. To represent your country, or the ladies category is a three-man team, you know. So it's if you're passionate about your discipline and you've worked hard to achieve it, you know, it's the highest honor, you know, yeah. Besides winning something, you know, it's the highest honor that you can get for that year to recognize your abilities.
Yeah. So during that event, you guys run White Flyer, correct, at the facility?
That's correct.
Yeah. So how many clay targets did you guys run that whole week? Do you know? Do you remember?
Yeah, we threw right about a million targets.
Wow.
In that one week.
Insane. Insane. And just the amount of crew you have to continue to restock that stuff is, I mean, just for the event we were at before that I was personally at was amazing, the amount of, I mean, you're constantly going and putting, you know, loading the throwers up.
Yeah, so it's just logistically, you know, you have just a lot of moving parts, right? You know, so if you're, I mean, just do the math, if a million clay targets, you know, so
yeah,
you know, you can think about how many are, you know, being going through one machine, right?
Crazy.
There's about 300 to 400 machines out there, so. And they hold 400 clays each, so you got a lot of refilling to do.
A lot of refilling. That's incredible, man. So what's your preferred – walk us through your go-to shotgun setup. How do you have yours personally set up? Chokes, all that stuff.
Yep. So I generally try to keep my chokes pretty simple. I shoot a modified in both barrels. I'm shooting an over and under. I shot a semi-auto for actually 18 years from the time I was – 10 years old to 28 years old, and then switch to an over and under.
What's the advantage of that? Why'd you switch?
There's advantages and disadvantages to both, you know. So a semi-auto is less recoil, a little bit lighter. I think a semi-auto is probably easier to learn with for a lot of people, yeah. You know. So if you got someone listening that's taking up clay shooting and like, oh man, I'd rather be able to save up and get an over and under. There's nothing wrong with a good semi-auto, you know. Semi-auto, a little bit less reliable, got a little bit more cleaning to do.
Yeah.
But if you take care of it and you can shoot extremely well with a semi-auto. I definitely recommend a semi-auto to anyone who's smaller in stature, ladies, kids. But I feel like I could go back to shoot a semi-auto tomorrow and be confident and comfortable with it. Over and under, less cleaning, a little bit simpler, less moving parts, a little bit more reliable because of the less moving parts. The definitely not much cleaning at all that you have to do besides wiping it off. Semi-auto being lighter, it's sometimes easier to make a correction if you do something wrong, like you know your setup is poor. And over and under, you have more mass, a little bit more weight. So sometimes the gun keeps moving a little bit better, you know. So if you're shooting a crossing shot, you have a little bit, and you have to be in front of it to hit it. You have a little bit of momentum of the gun keeps moving. So if you did something where you take your eye off the clay, the gun will slow down.
Yeah.
Okay. Like if you check your barrel too much, the gun will slow down. You can get away with that a little bit more, I would say, with an over and under because you have a little bit more momentum. Definitely more recoil in an over and under, less recoil in the semi-auto. So they're both, you know, there are people that are, you know, shoot competitive clays and say, oh, you need an over and under. That's not true.
Yeah.
You know, you can shoot them well with either gun.
So,
and I'm shooting personally now, I'm shooting a Beretta SL2. It's their newest model. I shot a Beretta DT11 for 10 or 12 years before that. And then a variety of the different semi-autos that they make, you know, if you're buying a semi-auto, there's a lot of good over and under shotguns. A lot of brands make a good over and under shotgun. If you're buying a semi-auto, you know, Beretta's pretty hard to beat, in the semi-auto space.
So throw ammo into the mix now, ammunition. So are you running different ammunition when you're training versus competing?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I'll shoot what would be the little bit cheaper variety in practice. You know, in Winchester, they have the Super Target and the Super X, which is not quite as high a quality in terms of the hardness of the lead,
right,
compared to the AA. So I'm definitely shooting only the AA in competition, and I shoot mostly the AA in practice as well. But the Super Target and the Super X is a great, great practice load for the average guy out on the range. If he's shooting practice, you know, any of those are fine. You know, there's nothing wrong with shooting the one that you can get a little bit cheaper. I'm shooting an ounce and an eighth, the Super Handicap AA. Ounce and an eighth. I do shoot both 7.5 shot and 8 shot at 1,250 foot per second. Until 2 years ago, though, I shot the 1 ounce 1,290 foot per second, the light handicap, and I shot the 1 ounce because I wanted less recoil. So you're definitely going to get less recoil in a 1 ounce than you're going to get in the ounce and an eighth. And you know, recoil can be cumulative. And I had a period of time where my elbow was bothering me and my neck was bothering me a little bit. And I, you know, switched to the 1 ounce for about 5 years, because of that. Switched back to the ounce and an eighth, the last 2 years. And, the gun that I'm currently using, I feel like kicks a little bit less than the gun I was using. So it enabled me to step it up and, you know, I don't have any issues with the recoil.
Yeah.
But you have to use a load that makes sense for you. You know, if you get a guy that's 150 pounds and, you know, he's shooting an ounce and an eighth with a high velocity, it could be too much.
Sure. So patterning, Kim Rodia, I was talking to her the other day. She patterns all of her guns, all of her shotguns on, you know, she has it on a table, on a lead sled, and she just wants to know, is that something that you do with chokes and kind of get the pattern information?
I shoot it at a board, you know, shoot it at a board, you know, just freehand, not necessarily, you know, off a sled or anything, just kind of shoot at a board like I was taking a shot. I do that really when I'm getting my stock set up, just to make sure that the way that I have the stock set up, the point of impact is going where I want it to. And then once I do that in the initial stages, if I'm hitting the targets hard, you know, and everything's, you know, then I don't really check anything. You know, if I, let's say I got a new set of chokes or something, if I went out and the I wasn't hitting the targets hard. I might go pattern it on a board again just to make sure. You can get a possibility that a choke is, you know, cut incorrectly and the pattern be off or something. It's rare. But the little bit of shooting I do at a pattern board is just when I'm initially getting comfortable with a gun to make sure that the point impact's going where I want.
Yeah. Back to competing. Is there a specific course out of all the courses that you've shot in your whole career? Is there one that gives you issues for some reason?
You know, I would say early in my shooting career, yes, right? Because there's, you know, we shoot in the desert and then we can shoot in the mountains of something below your feet and you could have, you know, stuff way below your feet or way overhead. So really what's challenging is backgrounds, you know, different backgrounds make the targets look farther or faster or closer or slower than they really are. You know, if you're out in the desert and they've got some low brush, it's extremely difficult to judge how far the birds are.
Yeah.
Because you can't see where the trap is. You can't see where it lands. It's, you know, landing behind some low, you know, some low desert brush. So with experience, the answer to your question is no. Before experience, yeah, I mean, anything that's different than what you're used to can be a challenge.
Can be a challenge. So as a competitor, you know, you've reached the highest level, but as an instructor, you've been instructing since you've been 15 years old, or, you know, what's your philosophy when it comes to coaching? Because I personally saw you when we were down, you had some students and you guys were, you know, going through the course. And I just was really impressed with how you handled that. It was all so positive. Really, you're the way you handled the coach student relationship was I thought was just pure class. And maybe that's just because you've been doing it for so long. But what is your philosophy when it comes to coaching?
I mean, it's kind of starts with my philosophy and mindset on everything. You know, I'm going to go out there and do 100% effort to make sure that I'm giving that person, you know, all the information that I can give them and all of my energy to make them a better shooter. At the end of the day, they're paying me to make them a better shot.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm going to devote all of my energy for that 2 hours that I'm with them or however long the session is to making sure that we do that. You know, and it's a personal, I take it as a personal challenge to me, you know, so besides the fact that it's my business, you know, the better I can make them, the better my business grows.
Yeah.
So then I'm more successful. They're more successful. You know, it's inherently in my best interest to give a, you know, 100% every guy that walks through the door. You know, sometimes the challenge is, and this is probably the part that I'm really good at, you know, not every person that you have on the range has the same capabilities. Not every person you have on the range has the same amount of experience. Not all of them are going to practice as much as the, you know, they might need to. You know, you have all different things that, you know, can make one student, you know, more likely to be successful than, than the next. You know, I treat every one of them exactly the same, you know, so I have people that are, you know, competing at the highest level, you know, right alongside of me. You know, that student just beat me this past weekend. Right. And so I treat, though, the guy who shows up and is less coordinated and has less abilities exactly the same, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's part of my big success, you know, in that. And I take it as a personal challenge because it's just as important for that guy to be as good as he can be as it is for the guy that might win the championship, right? You know, so and I treat him exactly the same way.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I feel like, you know, there's a – Dan Carlisle was my coach as a kid, and, you know, he's a really good coach. He's kind of very disciplined in saying, come on, I need you to do this, I need you to do that, you know. So he keeps you, you know, on track and motivated. But he's also super encouraging, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so you teach someone saying, okay – that was good, but here's what I need you to do. Okay.
That's what I saw from you, though. And you could tell that style rubbed off. Yeah.
Yeah. You just told them, you know, okay, you're doing a good job, but this is what we need to do next. Right. So that's positive. You know, that's motivating. You know, when the person gets done their lesson, they have to be more skilled, and you have to teach them. They have to be, there's three things that have to happen when someone's done a lesson. They have to be more knowledgeable. Step one. Okay. You hope that they're a little bit more skilled. Part of the skill has to be developed in practice, though. Okay. And the last part that you can leave them with is they have to be more confident than they were when they got there. Yeah. Okay. So they're really there to learn knowledge, build some skill, and send them home with the homework to build the rest of the skill and instill in them some confidence in what they're understanding and learning so that they can go out and practice on their own and build their own, you know, success and confidence up, you know, without you.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think the student, at least one of the students when I was out there, I think she might have driven like 4 hours or 5 hours. I mean, you have students from all around the country that show up to get instruction, don't you?
Oh yeah. This week alone. I have a kid from Mississippi this week. I have a kid, you know, the kid from Mississippi is young. He's 13. I have a, you know, 25-year-old guy coming from Texas. I have a 65 or 70-year-old guy coming from Chicago.
Yeah.
So on a given week, I can have people fly in from all over, and they might be a kid learning and he's real into it and his parents are supporting him fully to kind of really get to the next level. Or I have a guy who's 70 years old and he's doing this for his hobby in retirement, but he wants to do as good as he can do at it. And he might be competing. He might not be competing. Right. Yeah. You know, so, but regardless, you know, they're coming a long way, you know, and their goal is to, you know, is to get better.
Yeah. And as an instructor for, you know, 25 plus years now, you've seen elite, you've seen, just like you said, shooters in their 70s that just want to be as good as they can. But when you look at the elite shooters, what is it that separates that person outside? Obviously there's work ethic. I mean, that is obviously the things that you've talked about: work ethic, routine, battling the biggest stages and, you know, overcoming a lot of that. But what is it? Is there a skill? Is there a hand eye? Like, what is it?
Yeah, I mean, most of it, you know, I get asked this question a lot, right? Whether it's in an interview for an article or in a podcast. And the 90% of it is building a skill set that starts with good technique, starts with good fundamentals and good technique. And then you consistently pursue, you know, that pursuit of excellence, you know, in that technique and skill set, and you build experience through time. You know, you need to get the experience competing. If you don't have the experience competing, you're not going to get there. You need to have good technique and fundamentals and learn that. There is some just ability, you know, that people possess, but it's very rarely that's the factor that defines someone. You know, we're not really doing a discipline that you have to be, you know, the fastest or the strongest or the tallest, or you don't even need the best reflexes. I mean, surely the guy that's 25 is probably going to be better, you know, assuming they've got the same experience level and training and fundamentals, probably going to be better than the guy that's 70.
Sure.
Okay. But we would hold that true in any sport, any right? Sport. Yeah. So, you know, if there's a, I don't really think that there's a, you know, I don't consider myself, you know, naturally talented at all compared to a lot of the, you know, I have lots of students that I've met throughout the years that are naturally a lot better than I am, just by how good I can see them do things with, you know, minimal amount of time and effort, right? You know, where they are in their learning curve and how successful they can be sometimes. You know, so it's good technique, good fundamentals, experience. You know, you have to keep doing the same thing if you think it's correct, even when your results aren't as good as you want them to be. Sure. You know, yeah. You can fail or come up short, you know, 5 years in a row, and the sixth year things all start to come together for you.
Yeah.
Because you built that skill set now strong enough, because the ability to execute at the highest level means that your subconscious has developed that skill set. So everyone's subconscious develops that skill set at different rates, mm-hmm. you know. So you need opportunity. You know, if there's one thing that all the champions have, they had the opportunity to get out there and practice and pursue that, right? Now, sometimes that opportunity means that, you know, some kid is 13 and his parents are flying him up to meet with me, you know, five times a year, and we're training him at the highest level, and he lives on a farm and he's practicing on traps at his house, okay? Wow. And that's what opportunity means. Mm-hmm. For other people, that means opportunity is, you know, at a person's at a point in their life and they're 20 years old and, you know, they decide they're going to devote their life to this and shoot and, you know, shoot and go to competitions and take a chance, right? Yeah. Yeah. That, you know, maybe they're heading down the wrong path and they're not going to make it and they're not going to be, you know, a top level competitor, you know, and they're sacrificing their, you know, their future financial stability, but this is what they're going for, you know? Yeah. And, you know, so, you know, sometimes opportunity means that you took a risk on yourself, you know, that you,
sure.
that you might've came up short. So without that commitment, no one gets there. Right. You know, so, you can have someone that's really good and really talented and just for whatever doesn't have the opportunity to do it, whether they live too far from a range, they don't have the means to practice, you know, they can have a lot more natural abilities than the next guy and might not make it,
sure.
you know, to that highest level, to the champion level that you're talking about.
If you were to guess, how many clays have you busted in your life?
I'm not sure how many I busted, but I have a pretty good idea of how many I shot at. I've shot about 25,000 rounds a year, 20 to 25,000 rounds a year for 31 years, you know, so
650,000 or whatever. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, 20 times, 20,000 times 31 is over 600,000.
Yeah, that's incredible. That's unreal. So, I mean, obviously hearing protection is vital, in the sport.
Yeah.
Do you wear, in-ear or over-ear? What do you wear for hearing protection?
I just wear a foam plug. I wear a foam plug and I bury it in my ear. You know, I occasionally take it out, you know, when I'm talking and stick it back in, but I use it so it's comfortable for me. And if you use a foam plug correctly, mm-hmm. it's one of the absolute most effective forms of hearing protection that you can have. There's a lot of great options out there with muffs and electronics. And but for me personally, if I wear a molded earplug 9 hours a day, you know, my ear hurts.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's
what's
I'm kind of rare. Most of the top shooters are using something electronic or something molded, et cetera, but I've just stuck with a foam plug.
Yeah. Well, I think for you though, I mean, you're on the, whether you're instructing or shooting, I mean, you're on that course, you live it. Some of these guys are, you know, going in there shooting 2-3 hours a day, but you're on the, I mean, you might be out there for 10 hours a day. So you got to have something comfortable, I would imagine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
The Red W, the Horse and Rider, what's it mean to you to be just associated with that Winchester brand?
I'm super proud of it. You know, I've been with Winchester, I believe, since 2019. And, you know, I would have always considered it the Winchester AA, the best show on the market. Even when I was sponsored by someone else. And, to be honest with you, there wasn't a lot of opportunities, you know, to be sponsored by Winchester, you know, growing up as a kid and even into my, in my 20s and even into my 30s, you know, they just, they weren't kind of as present in the sporting clay space as they are now. And Winchester has stepped up big time in the sporting clay space. And, you know, they're at all our major championships and providing ammo and had ammo for all the major competitions when ammo was scarce, and made sure that the competitions were able to take place because of that. So I'm definitely proud of it. It's, you know, it's kind of an iconic brand, right? You know, so it's like, you know, I do a lot of competitive sport fishing, and we run a charter boat in the summertime. There's a lot of people in that space that, you know, that hunt or, you know, do some clay shooting. They might not do it seriously, but they're, you know, they're outdoorsmen, right? If you're a charter boat captain or you're, you know, a fishing mate on a boat, you, you probably have a chance that you've, you know, you might go out and shoot clays or hunt, et cetera. Yeah. You know, when people, you know, when people, if I have a Winchester shirt on, we go, oh, you shoot Winchester ammo? I'm like, yeah, I'm sponsored by them. You know, people are like, really? You know, like, you know, it's a, outside of our small world, it's, you know, it's a big brand.
It is.
You know, and I'm proud of that.
And you guys, for the World English, you built a Winchester ammo barn, didn't you, on the property?
Yeah, so we had a, we had an ammo barn there, and we added on to it and put a Winchester storefront in, added onto the barn and expanded the barn. So we carry a full selection of Winchester ammo. We have all the different target loads from the, you know, small gauge loads, you know, 1 ounce, ounce and an eighth, the cheaper, more practice, you know, price point load, and then all the highest quality AA stuff as well.
Yeah. So this year, what's next for you? What's your tournament schedule look like? What's on the agenda for 2025?
I'm going to shoot. I just got back from the tournament last week, and then I've got about 10 tournaments planned throughout the year. Some of them kind of strategically to prepare myself for some of the most biggest ones, to have something, you know, a competition before that. So the biggest ones for me this year will be the U.S. Open, the last week of April into the first week of May. Then we have the World Sporting Championship, World English Sporting Championship in England in July. The following week after that is the World FITES in Cyprus. And then the year ends with the biggest one of the National Championship in October in San Antonio. So those are the four biggest for me. We're hosting competitions at my range throughout the year. We've got six competitions planned here, and then pick up some different, you know, tournaments, some of the tour events. Winchester sponsors the NSCA Championship Tour. I'll pick up a couple of those throughout, you know, throughout the season, but really kind of focus on those four that I talked to you about, you know. So my goal is to add one of those four, if not more than one, to my resume this season.
Yeah, so I mean, you're basically doing the Tiger Woods. You're going to the big ones, and you're kind of, or are you going to all of them?
No, I mean, look, you could shoot. There's some of my peers. If I'm going to do 10 major championships, you know, with the four biggest, you know, there's some of my peers that are doing 20.
Yeah.
You know, that's not realistic for me for, you know, more than one
running
reason.
The business, all the stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Family, business, you know, longevity of my career, you know, you have to, you know, there's definitely some balance to that for me personally anyway, that, you know, I can't be gone for, you know, you could figure an average competition is you're going to be gone for 5 days, minimum a day there, day back, and minimum of 3 days. So I can't do 100 days away from home, you know, just, I don't want to, you know, so if I don't get my, you know, my schedule is super calculated. Like when we plan this podcast, you know, I'm occupied, you know, every day doing something.
Sure.
So I have to be, to reach my potential and stay at what I think is going to get me at the highest level and keep me at the highest level for as long as possible, I have to be calculated. Like, so there's a couple of the tour events this year that I'm not doing, because I want to go to a different competition that happens to fall just before you know, the world championship, right? Yeah. You know, so there's like two tour events when we get back from the world championship. Well, the world championship is, you know, what I want to be adding to on my resume, right? So I need to be prepared before that, you know, not go to a championship two weeks after, right?
For sure.
That doesn't have, it's not quite as big of a title.
Yeah. Well, Anthony, man, thank you so much for taking almost an hour now to out of your day. And I know how structured your days are, and I know how busy you are. So thank you for taking the time. And we'll be following you this year. And good luck over the course of the season. And definitely we'll be keeping track.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure getting on here with you. And if we need to do it again, just let me know. We'll try it again another time.
Right on. Thanks, Anthony.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks so much for listening to this week's show. Please make sure you click the follow button on your podcast apps so you never miss a new episode. This episode was produced by Aaron Cox and Jason Gilbertson, engineered by Jason Freer, directed by Chad Andrus, written and edited by Jason Brown, with behind-the-scenes photography by Kelsey Myers. I'm Jason Brown, and you've been listening to the Winchester Life Podcast. See you next time.